Dan Media presents Your Coach in a Box, affordable, life-changing audio programs. The Drunkard's Walk, How Randomness Rules Our Lives, by Leonard Mlodinow, narrated by Lloyd James. Prologue. A few years ago, a man won the Spanish National Lottery with a ticket that ended in the number 48. Proud of his accomplishment, he revealed the theory that brought him the riches. "I dreamed of the number 7 for 7 straight nights," he said, "and 7 times 7 is 48. Those of us with a better command of our multiplication tables might chuckle at the man's error. But we all create our own view of the world and then employ it to filter and process our perceptions, extracting meaning from the ocean of data that washes over us in daily life. And we often make errors that, though less obvious, are just as significant as his. The fact that human intuition is ill-suited to situations involving uncertainty was known as early as the 1930s, when researchers noted that people could neither make up a sequence of numbers that passed mathematical tests for randomness, nor recognize reliably whether a given string was randomly generated. In the past few decades, a new academic field has emerged to study how people make judgments and decisions when faced with imperfect or incomplete information. Their research has shown that when chance is involved, people's thought processes are often seriously flawed. The work draws from many disciplines, from mathematics and the traditional sciences, as well as cognitive psychology, behavioral economics, and modern neuroscience. But although such studies were legitimated by a recent Nobel Prize in economics, their lessons, for the most part, have not trickled down from academic circles to the popular psyche. This book is an attempt to remedy that. It is about the principles that govern chance, the development of those ideas, and the manner in which they play out in politics, business, medicine, economics, sports, leisure, and other areas of human affairs. It's also about the way we make choices and the processes that lead us to make mistaken judgments and poor decisions when confronted with randomness or uncertainty. Information that is lacking often invites competing interpretations. That's why such great effort was required to confirm global warming, why drugs are sometimes declared safe and then pulled from the market, and presumably why not everyone agrees with my observation that chocolate milkshakes are an indispensable component of a heart-healthy diet. Unfortunately, the misinterpretation of data has many negative consequences, both large and small. As we'll see, for example, both doctors and patients often misinterpret statistics regarding the effectiveness of drugs and the meaning of important medical tests. Parents, teachers, and students misunderstand the significance of exams such as the SAT, and wine connoisseurs make the same mistakes about wine ratings. Investors draw invalid conclusions from the historical performance of mutual funds. In sports, we have developed a culture in which, based on intuitive feelings of correlation, a team's success or failure is often attributed largely to the ability of the coach. As a result, when teams fail, the coach is often fired. Mathematical analysis of firings in all major sports, however, has shown that those firings had, on average, no effect on team performance. An analogous phenomenon occurs in the corporate world, where CEOs are thought to have superhuman power to make or break a company. Yet time and time again, at Kodak, Lucent, Xerox, and other companies, that power has proved illusory. In the 1990s, for instance, when he ran GE Capital Services under Jack Welch, Gary Wendt was thought of as one of the smartest businessmen in the country. Wendt parlayed that reputation into a $45 million bonus when he was hired to run the troubled finance company, Conseco. Investors apparently agreed that, with Wendt at the helm, Conseco's troubles were over. The company's stock tripled within a year. But 2 years after that, Wendt abruptly resigned. Conseco went bankrupt, and the stock was trading for pennies. Had Wendt's task been impossible? Was he asleep at the wheel? Or had his coronation rested on questionable assumptions? For example, that an executive has a near-absolute ability to affect a company, or a person's single past success is a reliable indicator of future performance. On any specific occasion, one cannot be confident of the answers without examining the details of the situation at hand. I will do that in several instances in this book, but more important, I will present the tools needed to identify the footprints of chance. To swim against the current of human intuition is a difficult task. As we'll see, the human mind is built to identify for each event a definite cause, and can, therefore, have a hard time accepting the influence of unrelated or random factors. And so the first step is to realize that success or failure sometimes arises neither from great skill nor from great incompetence, but from, as the economist Armin Alkian wrote, fortuitous circumstances. Random processes are fundamental in nature and are ubiquitous in our everyday lives, yet most people do not understand them or think much about them. The title, The Drunkard's Walk, comes from a mathematical term describing random motion, such as the paths molecules follow as they fly through space, incessantly bumping and being bumped by their sister molecules. That can be a metaphor for our lives, our paths from college to career, from single life to family life, from first hole of golf to 18th. The surprise is that the tools used to understand the drunkard's walk can also be employed to help understand the events of everyday life. The goal of this book is to illustrate the role of chance in the world around us, and to show how we may recognize it at work in human affairs. I hope that after this tour of the world of randomness, you, the reader, will begin to see life in a different light, with a deeper understanding of the everyday world. Chapter 1. Peering Through the Eyepiece of Randomness. I remember as a teenager watching the yellow flame of the Sabbath candles dancing randomly above the white paraffin cylinders that fueled them. I was too young to think candlelight romantic, but I still found it magical, because of the flickering images created by the fire. They shifted and morphed, grew and waned, all without apparent cause or plan. Surely, I believed, there must be rhyme and reason underlying the flame, some pattern that scientists could predict and explain with their mathematical equations. "Life isn't like that," my father told me. "Sometimes things happen that cannot be foreseen." He told me of the time when, in Buchenwald, the Nazi concentration camp in which he was imprisoned and starving, he stole a loaf of bread from the bakery. The baker had the Gestapo gather everyone who might have committed the crime and line the suspects up. "Who stole the bread?" the baker asked. When no one answered, he told the guards to shoot the suspects one by one until either they were all dead or someone confessed. My father stepped forward to spare the others. He did not try to paint himself in a heroic light, but told me that he did it because he expected to be shot either way. Instead of having him killed, though, the baker gave my father a plum job as his assistant. "A chance event," my father said. "It had nothing to do with you, but had it happened differently, you would never have been born." It struck me then that I have Hitler to thank for my existence, for the Germans had killed my father's wife and two young children, erasing his prior life. And so were it not for the war, my father would never have emigrated to New York, never have met my mother, also a refugee, and never have produced me and my two brothers. My father rarely spoke of the war. I didn't realize it then, but years later it dawned on me that whenever he shared his ordeals, It was not so much because he wanted me to know of his experiences, but rather because he wanted to impart a larger lesson about life. War is an extreme circumstance, but the role of chance in our lives is not predicated on extremes. The outline of our lives, like the candle's flame, is continuously coaxed in new directions by a variety of random events that, along with our responses to them, determine our fate. As a result, life is both hard to predict and hard to interpret. Just as, looking at a Rorschach blot, you might see Madonna and I, a duck-billed platypus, the data we encounter in business, law, medicine, sports, the media, or your child's third-grade report card, can be read in many ways. Yet interpreting the role of chance in an event is not like interpreting a Rorschach blot. There are right ways and wrong ways to do it. We often employ intuitive processes when we make assessments and choices in uncertain situations. Those processes, no doubt, carried an evolutionary advantage when we had to decide whether a saber-toothed tiger was smiling because it was fat and happy, or because it was famished and saw us as its next meal. But the modern world has a different balance, and today those intuitive processes come with drawbacks. When we use our habitual ways of thinking to deal with today's tigers, we can be led to decisions that are less than optimal or even incongruous. That conclusion comes as no surprise to those who study how the brain processes uncertainty. Many studies point to a close connection between the parts of our brain that make assessments of chance situations and those that handle the human characteristic that is often considered our prime source of irrationality, our emotions. Functional magnetic resonance imaging, for example, shows that risk and reward are assessed by parts of the dopaminergic system, a brain reward circuit important for motivational and emotional processes. The images show, too, that the amygdala, which is also linked to our emotional state, especially fear, is activated when we make decisions couched in uncertainty. The mechanisms by which people analyze situations involving chance are an intricate product of evolutionary factors, brain structure, personal experience, knowledge, and emotion. In fact, the human response to uncertainty is so complex that sometimes different structures within the brain come to different conclusions and apparently fight it out to determine which one will dominate. For example, if your face swells to 5 times its normal size, 3 out of every 4 times you eat shrimp, the logical left hemisphere of your brain will attempt to find a pattern. The intuitive right hemisphere of your brain, on the other hand, will simply say, avoid shrimp. At least that's what researchers found in less painful experimental setups. The game is called probability guessing. In lieu of toying with shrimp and histamine, subjects are shown a series of cards or lights, which can have 2 colors, say, green and red. Things are arranged so that the colors will appear with different probabilities, but otherwise without a pattern. For example, red might appear twice as often as green in a sequence like red, red, green, red, green, red, red, green, green, red, 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 and so on. The task of the subject, after watching for a while, is to predict whether each new member of the sequence will be red or green. The game has 2 basic strategies. One is to always guess the color that you notice occurs most frequently. That is the route favored by rats and other non-human animals. If you employ this strategy, you are guaranteed a certain degree of success, but you are also conceding that you will do no better. For instance, if green shows up 75% of the time, and you decide to always guess green, you will be correct 75% of the time. The other strategy is to match your proportion of green and red guesses to the proportion of green and red you observed in the past. If the greens and reds appear in a pattern, you can figure out the pattern. This strategy enables you to guess right every time. But if the colors appear at random, you would be better off sticking with the first strategy. In the case where green randomly appears 75% of the time, the second strategy will lead to the correct guess only about 6 times in 10. Humans usually try to guess the pattern, and in the process, we allow ourselves to be outperformed by a rat. But there are people with certain types of post-surgical brain impairment, called a split brain, that precludes the right and left hemispheres of the brain from communicating with each other. If the probability experiment is performed on these patients, such that they see the colored light or card with only their left eye and employ only their left hand to signal their predictions, it amounts to an experiment on the right side of the brain. But if the experiment is performed so as to involve only their right eye and right hand, it is an experiment on the left brain. When researchers performed these experiments, they found that, in some patients, the right hemisphere always chose to guess the more frequent color, and the left hemisphere always tried to guess the pattern. Making wise assessments and choices in the face of uncertainty is a rare skill. But like any skill, it can be improved with experience. In the pages that follow, I will examine the role of chance in the world around us, the ideas that have been developed over the centuries to help us understand that role, and the factors that often lead us astray. The British philosopher and mathematician Bertrand Russell wrote, "We all start from native realism, that is, the doctrine that things are what they seem. We think that grass is green, that stones are hard, and that snow is cold. But physics assures us that the greenness of grass, the hardness of stones, and the coldness of snow are not the greenness of grass, the hardness of stones, and the coldness of snow that we know in our own experience, but something very different." In what follows, we will peer at life through the eyepiece of randomness and see that many of the events of our lives, too, are not quite what they seem, but rather something very different. In 2002, the Nobel Committee awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics to a scientist named Daniel Kahneman. Economists do all sorts of things these days. They explain why teachers are paid so little, why football teams are worth so much, and why bodily functions help set a limit on the size of hog farms. A hog excretes 3 to 5 times as much as a human, so a farm with thousands of hogs on it often produces more waste than the neighboring cities. Despite all the great research generated by economists, the 2002 Nobel Prize was notable because Kahneman is not an economist. He is a psychologist, and for decades, with the late Amos Tversky, Kahneman studied and clarified the kinds of misperceptions of randomness that fuel many of the common fallacies I will talk about in this book. The greatest challenge in understanding the role of randomness in life is that although the basic principles of randomness arrive from everyday logic, many of the consequences that follow from those principles prove counterintuitive. Kahneman and Tversky's studies were themselves spurred by a random event. In the mid-1960s, Kahneman, then a junior psychology professor at Hebrew University, agreed to perform a rather unexciting chore, lecturing to a group of Israeli Air Force flight instructors on the conventional wisdom of behavior modification and its application to the psychology of flight training. Kahneman drove home the point that rewarding positive behavior works, but punishing mistakes does not. One of his students interrupted, voicing an opinion that would lead Kahneman to an epiphany and guide his research for decades. "I have often praised people warmly for beautifully executed maneuvers, and the next time they always do worse," the flight instructor said. "And I've screamed at people for badly executing maneuvers, and by and large the next time they improve. Don't tell me that rewards work and punishment doesn't work. My experience contradicts it." The other flight instructors agreed,